Hello, everybody. We are back. It has been a long hiatus. Tax season was busier than we thought it would be. And so we took a little bit of a break from doing the podcast, but you are here and listening to what is probably one of the only financial podcasts that isn't an hour-long commercial for somebody's business. So... we get the pleasure of talking through issues we see in the news, and then trying to bring in some of these wonderful planning topics that we do classes all through the valley on. Grayson is the writer of our blog and keeps us up to date on what's going on in the markets. Grayson, I see China. Or Gina, as we're supposed to call them now. What's going on over there?
They are screwing up bigly.
Bigly, the word of the year.
The word,
or is that the word of last year?
Well, I think it's the word of this administration.
This administration.
Yeah. So, we're just talking about credit markets in China. We have referenced them over and over and over the last couple of years. I mean, this is so macroeconomic, Scott. This is such big picture stuff that...
So we're beyond 10,000 feet?
We're beyond 10,000 feet. We're more like 50,000 feet. So okay. So when you see, when you're talking about such macroeconomic topics... Well, what does that mean today? You know, you get a little bit away from what that means to day-to-day life, but it's good to have a perspective of how China got where it is, how the world economy has gotten where it is as well. So, you know, we keep referencing that ever since the financial crisis, right, that is continually referenced, 2008, 2009, worldwide financial crisis, China has been really the engine of growth for the entire world economy. You know, we had summer of 2015, we had some real hiccups in the Chinese markets, in commodity markets, reflecting Chinese problems. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Now it looks like we might be started back in some crazy China situation again. Looks like there, at very least, there are cracks in the dam showing. I'm not saying that China is coming unraveled presently, but when you're talking about they're the engine of growth for the world economy, and that has been built on credit,
free money.
We at least have to talk about it. So, China's about 15% of the world. We'll put some numbers on it to help it take shape in your large mind. So, I was going to say big head, but then, you know, that has different connotations. So, the Chinese economy is roughly 15% of the world's economy, right?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
The credit growth since 2005 of the entire globe... 50% of it's Chinese.
So the amount of debt that was created, half of it's Chinese debt.
That's correct.
Okay.
So it is an absolutely ridiculous credit bubble. I mean, it's just that simple. It's an absolutely insane credit bubble. You know, the banking system assets over there are 300% of their GDP. Think about that. So you look back at our credit crisis from 2008, and there was, you know, we had some big credit issues, of course, within a banking system of assets of 15 trillion, 12 trillion, somewhere in there, less than 100% of our GDP, right?
Mm-hmm.
China's banking assets are 300% of their GDP. So what is a banking asset, right? Well, just to put it in perspective, the car loan that you consider debt, some bank out there considers an asset of theirs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your home line of credit,
Some bank out there considers that an asset. It's debt to you. It's an asset to a bank. So all this money that's going to be paid back, theoretically, in China has been the driving force of the entire world economy. So we probably need to pay attention to that if we see some hiccups, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you and I talked about this on the podcast several months ago. You know, cracks in the dam several months ago. We've got some more issues now. It's so macroeconomic. Maybe this is the beginning of a deleveraging, 2008 style, for China. How's that sound?
Well, it sounds scary, but it seems to me that this is such a terrible way to put this, but we as a global... As global economists have learned our lesson from 2008 and have a hair trigger on stimulus and buying of assets that are non-performing to get them out of the system.
Wait, who's we?
We, the global economists. So whether it's China's economists or centralized government or us or any other country out there that is developed enough to have a problem like this, it sure seems to me that the government intervention is the wild card that we just don't... which makes timing this impossible.
Timing this is absolutely impossible. Right. I agree with that.
I mean, I think everybody agrees there's fundamental problems out there, but those fundamental problems keep getting pushed off to another day.
Yeah. Yes, they do. Kick the can down the road. Where does the road end?
And I'm simply saying I don't know if the road ends because the government in China could just look at the books and say every time there's a non-performing asset, we'll buy it.
Okay.
And forgive it.
Right, and buy it with what? I mean, sooner or later...
Who's buying Japan's debt?
Right. So
themselves.
Right, so this credit system... you make a good point, though. I mean, it's... obviously easier for all leaders, especially political leaders, to brush this stuff under the rug, kick the can down the road, and not deal with any economic reality, right? Not on my watch. You're absolutely right. Sooner or later, the currency will be the judge. Unless I don't understand the laws of economics, unless I don't understand the laws of gravity, the laws of physics, if the laws of physics are completely changed, and yes, the entire globe can consume more than it produces, if that is the new economic vortex we're in, then I'm wrong. Sooner or later, bad debts come home to roost.
So right? The Bermuda Triangle could have got bigger.
Could have gotten would be proper English. So, all right, do you follow me?
Yes.
I mean, there is a day of reckoning. And I started the podcast telling you, look, this is 50,000 feet. I have no idea when. It's just... it is staggering how much debt there is in China. It is more staggering how much bad debt there is in China. So you should at least have it on your radar. Is that fair?
So the loan bundles, you know, which is kind of what got us in trouble is the bundling of loans getting rated AAA and the amount of people that weren't paying their mortgages in each one of those bundles kept increasing. And at some point, they ended up having to downgrade all these bundles of loans because they were non-performing, and the cookie started crumbling thereafter. So relate that, because the movie Big Short, if you've ever seen it, it's a great description in layman's terms as to how it all fell apart in the United States. And it's a movie. There's obviously a lot more that went on, but helps all of us normal people that don't sit and stare at this stuff on a daily basis and aren't economics professors, helps us really kind of understand what's been going on. How can we extrapolate that into China? Do they bundle loans the way we did into securities and have
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's called their wealth management products, coming out of mostly banks, some non-bank financial institutions over there. Will package up short-term liabilities backed by long-term assets, and when the long-term assets stop performing. And there's a ton of smoke and mirrors in this. It's a shadow market of debt, and in the weekly blog, I likened those exactly to the mortgage backs of 2008, even before you brought that up. So that is out there in China. It's just when we're talking about China. In a ridiculous, you know, $32-34 trillion banking system, whatever it's morphed into, understand that there's a ton more gray area in China than there ever was over here. Right? They don't have the sophisticated corporate bond market making mechanism. They don't have a lot of the sophisticated products that we have within the banking system. They don't have the kind of accounting standards. Well, some of our accounting standards aren't really adhered to at this point, but they don't even have them in China. So,
is there personal bankruptcy in China?
Yes, but corporate bankruptcy is a completely different deal. They rarely allow corporations to go bankrupt. Right? There aren't a lot of corporate bankruptcies over there. And speaking of that, I mean, we could sit here and talk for hours and hours and hours. You know, that,
no, it's okay. We have 45 minutes.
That lends us to, the credit markets in the rest of the world. If this is going on in China, and there are at least cracks in the dam in China, and I say cracks in the dam because, look, the commodity markets are completely dependent on China, all of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this before. A lot of debt, a lot of sketchy debt worldwide is owed by commodity producers, right? For the production of their commodities, they went into a lot of debt. China has been the buyer of last resort for a lot of commodities worldwide. If China's not buying, they're in trouble. They're not going to make money. They're not going to pay their debt back. Trillions of dollars of bad debt, right?
Okay.
And
when you say commodities, what are the bigger commodities that we're referring to?
Iron ore, coal, crude oil, of course. Crude oil is the king of all commodities. The agriculture markets... wheat, corn, soybeans to a lesser degree, copper,
and these industries metals. Have the huge amounts of debt.
Correct.
And yeah. You think, well, oil obviously is the big one, which has rebounded a little bit, but we've seen the pullback on that, and I noticed you're a bit, what is it, bearish on oil.
Yeah, there's a glut of crude oil. There's too much crude oil out there. And economic numbers do not look good. And the Fed's raising rates. Credit markets are tightening. So,
Are interest rates trying to rise in China?
They're trying to tighten them up a little bit. They're trying to manage a deleveraging. They understand that they've got lots and lots too much leverage.
What's a 10-year interest rate in China?
Well, they don't. It's a different mechanism. It's most of the longer term interest rates are in the 4-5%.
Okay, short term.
But it's a different mechanism over there. They don't have the sophisticated bond markets that we have.
Yeah.
So it's a different mechanism over there. you know, and they're still out there talking about 6 or 7% economic growth every year, and it's just not coming to pass. The numbers are just not coming in like that.
Well, and let me ask the question, because I think government and corporate debt in an accounting world that is China, I think that stuff is a lot more manipulable than personal debt and the catalyst or what you know jumped off our 2008 crash was personal debt for the most part. And personal debt, the bankruptcies and all that type of stuff, that's what I guess to me I'd be more curious about in China is how much of all this 50% of the world's debt, how much of all this is personal debt?
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. There's enormously more corporate debt in China relative to their system versus the United States. Enormously. So our entire corporate debt, let's even it out. It's not quite, but let's call it $10 trillion is our corporate debt market and on a $19 trillion economy, right? Mm-hmm. Call it half.
Yeah.
It's actually a little bit less than that. We call it half. So let me say that again. Our corporate debt domestically is roughly half of our GDP.
Okay.
China's corporate debt is roughly 250% of its GDP.
Yes,
that's kind of your point.
That's a huge problem, yeah. but my point is...
They don't have the kind of personal debt we have here.
And that's where it makes me wonder, you know, once again, cracks in the dam, who cares? The government's got Band-Aids for every corporate debt or government debt.
So that's a good point. You know, I even wrote it in the blog today. There's an enormous pile of non-performing debt in China. It's a huge, huge problem. But it is absolutely taking different shape, and will any unwinding of it will take different shape than what happened here. The Chinese government isn't in as big of debt, although you could argue that corporate debt in China is
quasi-government, sure.
Right? But just sovereign debt isn't anything like as bad as it is here. It's just a little over half what it is here. They do have $3 trillion in foreign currency reserves. They do have, although the problem's bigger, they're better positioned to manage when you compare apples to apples with our 2008 bomb.
That's where China looks like a mountain of debt, but then when you dig in, I guess in when we talk about crashing of markets and we talk about global economic shutdown and the end is coming and the world's falling apart, I guess when I dig into that and realize that it's not the consumer debt that is way out of control, it's the corporate debt, let's just whittle it down to just the corporate debt there. It's a problem, but that's what quantitative easing fixes. Yeah. And you have a Chinese government that doesn't really freely allow the business bankruptcies. And so the possibility of as this corporate debt goes bad, them just buying up bad debt and forgiving it on their books sure sounds like to me everything's just fine.
Well, okay.
I say that first of jokingly.
All, you're right. First of all, nobody's saying there's the end of anything.
No, I understand. Yes.
Nobody's saying that. What I'm telling you is the banking system in China exploded at such a ridiculous pace. Exploded as in expanded.
Sure.
They expanded it recklessly. It has to restructure. And in the end, the best way to in the end, the Chinese yuan is going to be valued lower than it is today. That's really what I'm saying. There has to be a restructuring, and the Chinese currency will be devalued.
So this is obviously a very interesting topic, and you know, I've always enjoyed economics and global economics and all of that type of stuff. To me, it's fun to talk about and theorize and do things like that. But what does that mean for an investor? Somebody who's just trying to get into or through retirement, how does this relate to the choice of investments out there?
How does the Chinese situation relate to it?
Yeah.
Well, I think we at very least need to admit that we're in the later stages of an epic credit expansion. We're in the later stages of it. So when you look at the stock market here, pinned to all-time highs and barely budges, people don't feel the risk. Central banks are buying so many stocks that is at least part of the explanation of why stocks and especially bonds are still so highly priced. But when you see the credit market situation changing, you need to pay attention. The credit market situation is changing in China. Are they going to be able to manage it? Well, maybe. But it's I needed to put a different perspective on this too. You know, when you're talking about the hundreds of percent parabolic growth in Chinese, let's talk about corporate debt, right? Understand that is a bubble of some sorts expanding, and when it expands at that crazy pace, it usually doesn't end well. Historically, those never end well, right? Well, the first quarter in China, corporate debt issuance was negative.
Good. They're cleaning up things.
Well, right. So, again, is it the beginning of the end, you know, as you seem to be afraid that I'm saying? Or is it what's absolutely true is the credit markets over there are changing.
Okay.
Right?
The credit cycle is tightening, which when we talk about that just means there's no free flow of refinancing. So if somebody owes money, they can't just go refinance it into a new debt to pay off the old debt. It's not as easy to do.
Right.
And think of it as an individual with a mortgage that their mortgage just went to a variable interest rate and they can't afford their payment anymore. Well, if you've got good credit and people are lending to anybody anywhere, you can just go refinance that loan into a new mortgage and afford your payment. Well, the problem in 2008 was that the credit cycle was tightening from an individual person's standpoint. It was harder to get a mortgage. The values of houses were teetering, and now you just couldn't go refinance to fix your problem. And so this tightening of a credit cycle, whether it's from an individual's debt situation or a corporate debt situation, bonds are, you know, almost universally due and payable on their maturity. And if you can't afford to pay them back upon maturity, you go issue new bonds. Well, if that cycle is tightening, you're not able to just go do that anymore. And that is what creates this tumbling effect that happened in 2008. And that's why you always talk about credit cycles.
Yes.
And so I understand that and I don't want to call it a theory. It's a lot more than a theory, but I guess my question is how did 2008 change that, and why is it in my mind that I feel like we just band-aid over everything now and we've got such a hair trigger that we're just not going to let it fall anymore?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a hair trigger, and it's hard when you're living in a bubble to feel like it's a bubble, right?
Well, the overall sentiment is everybody fears that the market's going to crash. I mean, that's
what... No, everybody doesn't fear the
market. It's amazing, though, but every individual investor...
No, they don't.
Man, everybody I run into.
There are a lot of people very complacent about this. There's still a significant amount of fear out there. I will agree with you. It doesn't feel like a top in stock markets. So if everybody thinks I'm saying panic and sell and get your guns and gold and go up in the McDowell Mountains with a bunch of water, that's not what I'm saying. The credit cycle's tightening, but when you're in a bubble, you don't realize the reality of the situation you're in. If you take a step back and you look at, so here's a good example of how crazy the free credit situation has been. Okay, Amazon is destroying industries. They don't make any money. This isn't capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not capitalism. This is thank you. This is a big thank you to your central banks offering free capital. Amazon's capitalization is $500 billion, and they are annihilating retail. The entire retail industry is restructuring, largely because of, not just because of Amazon, but Amazon, again, is a good example. So their revenues are absolutely insane. Their valuation is $500 billion, Scott.
For a company doesn't make money.
Do you know how much on the total ever Amazon, the aggregate sum of the money they've made, do you know what it is?
Are you talking profits?
Profit. $5 billion ever. Total.
And they have a market cap of $500 billion.
They've got a sales margin. They've got a profit margin of less than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
But
isn't that like saying I just want 1% of China? Amazon says, well, I just want 2% of every transaction in the
right,
retail
but,
world
but
ever.
If they need capital to go buy build distribution centers to crush the Walmart, brick and mortar stores, that there's just billions of dollars thrown at them because of their cash flow.
Yeah.
Billions of it's free capital.
Well, and again, there's so many more games that can be played in the corporate debt world than there will be and can be in the consumer individual debt world. Amazon could dilute their shares and issue a whole bunch of new stock and pay off debt with that. There's a lot of different ways that businesses can handle this debt. I mean, we've all seen the absurd levels of some of these tech companies with no profits.
Some of them no revenues.
I mean, yeah. LinkedIn's falling apart because they can't figure out how to monetize it. But the market cap is ridiculous. The Facebooks of the world, Alphabet and Google. The value of these companies as the stock represents is absurd for the revenues that they're bringing in.
Yes.
But there's that, that what I call the goodwill on the books, the value of the company because they are the market. It's not that they own the market. It's that they created and are the market.
Yeah.
So, Google's
a monopoly.
Yeah. And so is Amazon, at least in the United States at this point. I've been on Alibaba's website, and I'll be real honest, it is so not functional compared to Amazon, but I'm sure Alibaba will get their act together and become a global power in China if they aren't considered one already.
I thought it was China.
China.
China. Yeah, yes, but do you understand my point? Interest rates in a downward curve for 35 years puts you in a perspective that you don't understand how out of whack it can get.
Well, especially
at the end of that curve, and there's no way that curve continues, right?
Well, exactly.
And when you were talking about the refinancing of debt, understand that the trend of 35 years of lower interest rates has kept a lot of zombie companies, a lot of zombie governments, a lot of zombie people out of bankruptcy just because they could refi at a lower rate. So there are a lot of, I mean, the Chicago pension system is a perfect example. The Chicago pension system is so insolvent, it isn't just dependent on low interest rates.
Yeah, well, at some point,
it's dependent on low interest rates that continue going lower.
Yeah.
Which obviously isn't going to happen. Chicago pension blowing up and either restructuring or getting bailed out is a when, not an if.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you talk about, well, we've just got a hair trigger on fixing everything, just printing money and getting out of it. Well, yeah, we do. Somehow, somewhere, when the credit cycle tightens, some of this is going to be answered for. Puerto Rico just filed for bankruptcy.
Yep.
Right? You're talking about $70 billion. That's a bigger number than we've seen with some of, you know, we've got a pretty heavy corporate bankruptcy rate right now. Most of this financial media doesn't talk about that, but it's a pretty heavy rate right now. But for a municipal debt, $70 billion is the biggest ever, and they're trying to default on it. They'll restructure it, you know. But the bondholders will take a haircut. They won't get zero.
Yeah.
So they'll restructure it. But $70 billion, that's, you know, that's coming home to roost. The piper has to be paid. Well, you know, financial markets don't seem that worried about $70 billion in Puerto Rico. Okay, well, we'll just keep marching on until another one of these happens that does affect the market. And I'm telling you, with the credit cycle tightening, sooner or later, it's coming. That doesn't mean that stock markets can't go higher before a bigger credit issue really triggers some restructuring.
So, restructuring of debt and relating that to our overall markets, It's if it's isolated and one at a time, Puerto Rico, and then we got to bail out Illinois, then we got to bail out New York, then we got to bail out. If it's one a year, does it really bother anybody?
No, and that's a question we can't answer.
No, we can only
speculate.
Right? It's frustrating.
I mean, Stockton, California was a big headline, and people made money selling doomsday newsletters talking about the municipal bond Armageddon that was here.
Yeah.
Then that was Stockton, California. Well, and that was about it.
Yeah, that's all you ever heard of it.
So yeah, it's speculation, but again, it's a 35-year trend.
Yeah.
Of lower interest rates. We never got negative here, but the Japanese and the Europeans took it negative. Now coming. Well, not so much in Europe, but in Japan, coming back positive.
Barely.
How that's the trend is over.
Yeah. Well, and so I guess here's how I can bring it to an individual investor standpoint. One, the first thing we have to realize is that whether it's municipal or corporate, bonds do have risk.
Yes.
Well, that's the first thing we have to. To extrapolate from a credit cycle tightening is just simply the fact that, let's say you owned a municipal bond. Puerto Rico, we gave them municipal bond status, didn't we? They're not a state in the United States.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. So, yeah, it's tax-free. That's why all these funds own it.
So we have these municipal bonds from from Puerto Rico, if I had one of those in my portfolio, I'd be at this point happy to see 40, 50 cents on the dollar back.
Yeah, that's complete speculation.
Oh, something sure.
Like that.
So understand that if
I would
you,
guess more like 60, but that's a guess.
The struggle that I seem to have in this interest rate environment is any upward trend in our interest rates, unfortunately, with all of this debt out there, it's hard to see it long-lived without a massive 2008 washout.
Agreed.
And that's the scariest thing about this.
It's literally impossible, Scott. When you're talking about
it's mathematically impossible.
It is mathematically impossible. When you're talking about debt rising faster than income, it's mathematically impossible.
So a little 0.25% here and there, hey, we have 4 rises in the interest rates this year. We're going to do a quarter each quarter. Well, you know, that's not anything really that meaningful. And what's crazy is, Grayson, what's been going on with long-term interest rates as we're trying to push short-term interest rates up?
Yeah, just a few trading sessions ago, the 30-year bond got below 3%. The 30-year Treasury got back below 3%, which means if you're keeping score at home, that the price of 30-year bonds, because of all the demand for 30-year bonds, skyrocketed again. After the election, people thought that Donald was going to bring inflation, so people ran away from bonds. Well, they're back.
It's amazing. So we're seeing a flattening of the curve, because if we're trying to push up short-term interest rates and our long-term interest rates are still falling, you know, we're going to be in a world where the 5-year interest rates are the same as 30-year interest rates.
Yeah, it's insane.
Which is absurd, and why anyone would be a consumer of that type of an investment doesn't make a huge amount of sense. And so, from an individual perspective, this world of interest rates, I got to say, it has us all questioning and looking at the world of safe investing. And those of you that come to my classes, a lot of our topics either directly talk about that or indirectly talk about the world of safe investing and the choices we have for our safe investments. And all of virtually anything that's considered a safe investment, virtually all of it is interest rate dependent. Virtually all of it. We used to go to the banks and just buy CDs. You know, the baby boomers, the bond world has been so fantastic for the last 30 years. The reality is bonds have blindly been the benchmark of safe investing out there. But when I'm looking at portfolios that are lucky to yield 3% from bonds, I don't know why I'm taking any risk for 3%.
Right.
You know, let's just say the best bond portfolio you could put together today is 4%. Let's just theoretically talk about that. If you could get a bond portfolio that has a yield, a payment to you of 4%, and you paid par pricing for it, do you have a manager or a mutual fund fee on top of that? And that really is that really is what the question ends up being is, okay, so I have a great bond portfolio at 4%, but I have a management fee of 1%. What are we yielding? Well, we're yielding 3%. Now, if interest rates rise, the value of my bonds goes down, so I just lost value in my portfolio, and I'm only getting paid 3%, so am I really getting paid 3%? Well, now the next problem is, what if one of those bonds was Puerto Rico? And now all of a sudden I just lost half of that one investment, and that ruined the entire portfolio. And I guess my biggest issue that I see out there is really keeping these things into perspective and understanding that if we're going to invest in something and it has risk, 3% is about your benchmark for risk-free investing. You can get 1% in a money market account, so you have 100% access with no risk. and no fees, and you'll earn about 1%. The world of, you know, the fixed rates you can get out there with no risk, you're looking at fixed annuities for 5 years for 3%. Those are out there. They're CDs with banks. You know, they're no different. They're exact same type of contract. They just happen to be with an insurance company, and they call them fixed annuities. But 3% with no risk, and your restriction is access to 10% of the money for 5 years. So each year for 5 years, you have access to 10% of the money. So why would I accept any risk if I'm not getting paid for that risk?
Well, the big thing is the average investor has no understanding of bonds. The average investor has, trust to a manager or trust to a Vanguard safe, whatever it's labeled, a conservative portfolio at Vanguard that they put their money in. They put
or the mutual fund world in 401ks. It's the retire at 2020s, right?
Yeah. Or if they have a blended fund, that's one of the marketing terms they use for part stocks, part bonds. They consider, it's lower risk. It's a blended fund, so they put their money in. They have no understanding of bonds. And when you are at the bottom of a 35-year trend, it's over. It can't continue like this. Do we agree on that?
Well, yeah, bonds are the highest value reasonably that they could be at this point.
Yes, the trend is over. So, yes, arguably, you could go straight sideways in interest rates, but you can't keep going down. You could go straight sideways in bonds, and yeah, you could have some 3% performance, and that's your safe portfolio. But what if interest rates go up at all?
Well, and that's the issue. Just understand, when you buy a bond or you buy a mutual fund and they're buying bonds at the highest price for the lowest interest rate. That's what we mean by that. They're the highest value they could possibly be out there. The value, the price you would pay for a bond is the highest it's ever been relative to the lowest interest rate that you're going to receive for that price you're paying for it. And so when these bonds, because most people are, you know, seem to use these mutual funds to invest in stuff like this, these mutual funds have to manage their portfolio, and they have bonds maturing all the time. So, Grayson, what are they buying out there in these bond mutual funds if, you know, who's crazy enough to go buy a 30-year bond for 3-4%?
Well, they are.
Well, that's one of the things they're buying, but they've, ever since 2008, they've been forced to buy treasuries as well. And if they're buying treasuries now, what kind of interest rates are they getting?
Garbage.
Little to nothing. So what does that mean they have to also go buy out there just to raise the yield in the portfolio, because treasuries aren't going to give them any yield for the investor?
Junk.
So, maybe Puerto Rico bonds?
Yep. Yeah, so it depends on the bond fund, right? I mean, a lot of bond funds by their charter can't buy junk. It has to be triple B or better. It has to be investment grade, right? You follow me?
Yes.
But so that's how all these high yield bond funds morphed out of, I mean, they just mushroomed out of nowhere over the last few years.
Wait, high yield? What's wrong with high yield? They get paid more.
Yeah, it's a marketing term for junk bonds.
There you go.
So when you look at the credit cycle, and it's not just tightening in China, right? It's tightening here too. If you have a similar to 2008 event, I'm saying if you have a similar to 2008 event, you have roughly twice the corporate debt that we did in 2008, and you have a much higher percentage of that corporate debt, much lower grade.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
You could easily see 40% of the junk bond world domestically default.
Okay.
And that's trillions of dollars.
Yep.
So
well, so let me functionally let me with Puerto Rico filing bankruptcy, defaulting, and all these bond mutual funds that we look up all the time when people come in with their portfolios and want us to take a look at them. I always pull up Morningstar, and I like to look at what's in the mutual funds to figure out, you know, what my opinion is before I just blanket throw an opinion out there. And so often I look at these mutual funds, and when there's bonds in them, I know I've seen Puerto Rico in a lot of those. So functionally, tell me whether it's specifics on regulatory side, if I owned a mutual fund that had Puerto Rico in it right now, am I just going to see an instant correction on the pricing mechanism? Because the pricing mechanism is a function of the net asset value. Are they immediately reevaluating the value of that particular investment in that mutual fund?
No, it's going to that's going to have to go through court. They're going to have to find a restructuring. It's going to be months before there's any revaluing of people's portfolios,
which is amazing. Depending on, if I own that mutual fund, I should be able to look in there and know that I own a Puerto Rico bond and sell that mutual fund right away, because at some point,
well, but
that
it,
piece will restructure.
Yeah, but it depends on the issue. I mean, some of these issues, there's, you know, they're trading in the secondary market, you know, flying all over the place in the secondary market. So some of them are being repriced as we talk.
Yeah.
So it depends on the issue.
Well, how you know, and this is something I've always struggled with the bond mutual funds, you know, since the regulations changing after 2008, is the function of the price of that bond mutual fund. Let's say it was one of its top 10 investments.
Right.
You know, it was 5% of the total portfolio, and we're only getting 50% back.
Yes, they took a 2.5% hit.
So they took a 2.5% hit. Does the pricing structure change by 2.5% instantly?
Yes. Yeah.
How often are they reevaluating the value of these portfolios in the bond world, in the bond mutual fund world? Is there a regulation that says daily we have to look at the net asset value and restructure the pricing, or... Because a lot of these bonds don't trade.
Yeah, right. That's the problem, right? Yeah. So valued according to who?
Yeah.
Valued according to somebody willing to buy it off you, that's completely different than valued off what some book valuation says. And so, yeah, there's a lot of gray area in that, and you'll generally be able to see a net asset value when you look up these bond funds when you're on. Right, so that's not a daily... I mean, it depends on the fund, depends on the structure. Is it high yield? You know, there are a lot of different moving parts. But just understand that that net asset value is not some mandate from God on what that thing is worth.
That's what scares me.
Yeah.
Is I look at some of these bond funds, and I'll look up a bond in there and realize that it's never traded, and it's so far into the junk bond world that... You know, it has zero value because nobody will ever buy it from you, and there's no way the entity could pay it back upon maturity.
Right.
So
it's kind of like that. It's kind of like those REITs, right? I mean, it's literally like Bernie Madoff stuff. You get a statement in the mail from your private REIT, and oh well, the valuation's this.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they say the valuation is. That doesn't mean that anybody's going to buy it from you at that.
That's what bothers me so much about bond mutual funds, is wrapping my brain around this quote-unquote net asset value. And my biggest fear, and I don't know that this is going to happen, I don't know, you know, maybe if we have another 2008 that the regulators are going to go in there and hardline it and say, here's exactly how it will be valued going forward, and we're just going to see a massive correction on every one of these bond mutual funds. But I don't think that anybody will actually do it. You don't want to see all these individual investors look at the price on their bond mutual fund and say, well, it's $30 a share, but oops, the net asset value literally dropped today with new regulations to $15 a share.
Oh, yeah.
And your price dropped down to $15 a share within an hour.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we're in a crazy, crazy world. When everybody wants to know how the central banks create so many currency units and yet there's no inflation.
Yeah.
Well, I'm here to submit to you that there's a ton of inflation. Look at bond prices. Look at stock prices. And it's really crazy with so much supposed purchasing power that people don't need to utilize right now. And they're okay with that because on paper it says it's still there.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing new here, right? This happens all the time. People think they have, people that worked at Enron 15 years ago thought they had all the purchasing power they'd ever need. And it just went poof. Yeah. That's what happens in these credit markets, right? There's not equity, it's credit. And it can just flat out disappear.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
The credit cycle's tightening. That's all. I just want to make sure that people understand that. And when, here's another good example. So, actually, we've been banging this drum for a couple of years, right? And again, I've never told anyone that I thought I knew exactly where the top was or anything like that. But
I thought the top was 18,000.
We were looking at corporate debt. I still look at corporate debt a lot, but I don't talk about it much with you. But you remember when we were talking about, hey, there are going to be some opportunities buying corporate debt at, below par.
Yeah.
Remember we were talking about
that? Oh, absolutely.
So summer 15, there were some opportunities. Summer 16, there were some opportunities. We took a couple of small steps down that road. Tentatively, because we thought that it...
Good bonds selling below par,
right.
With short maturity dates. So you're talking, Ed, just as an example, not a real example, but an IBM bond selling for 85 cents on the dollar with a maturity 4 years from now. Stuff like that.
Or less.
Or less.
I like it even less.
Even less. Okay.
So when we were looking at that, you have to scour through thousands and thousands of corporate bond issues to find these things. And there was, that could somehow meet the radar and never ended up meeting our criteria, but somehow got onto our radar was roughly 10%
mm-hmm.
of the corporate bond world, trading at a discount and at least worth taking a look at.
Yep.
Now we're talking about only about 1% exists.
Oh, jeez. The consuming of these bonds is still going on, which is just...
Yes. It's a bubble of all...
It's just insane.
It's an insane bubble. So,
but a lot of these companies can issue stock to pay back their bonds.
Well,
diluting their shares.
Sure.
I mean, from an individual handle the debt, they have more wiggle room.
Yeah, that's a short road.
Yeah,
that's
a really short road. I agree, but they've got more wiggle room.
But
we've also got a lot of bigger companies like the Microsofts and the Apples. They're all sitting on mountains of cash.
Yeah, true. So, but my point being, look, I think... how does all this whole discussion, how does it filter down to the small investor? It's very, very difficult, and I know...
Not the small investor, the individual investor.
Well, yeah, us 99%ers, whatever. We're not Ray Dalio. How about that? The understanding of the credit cycle is changing. There are potentials for... both big dangers and big opportunities.
Yeah.
You need a safe portfolio. I'm fine, with some stock exposure and still. And I know it's difficult, but don't be afraid of holding cash.
Yeah.
It may take 18 months. It may take 2 years. But I'm telling you, there are going to be enormous opportunities in buying... what were once overvalued assets that became undervalued assets.
Well, and that's why we lean so strongly on safety these days. And we do talk so much about all your choices in the safe investing world. A lot of it is really just to you know, try to get a little growth in the portfolio safely. But you know, if we see some significant turbulence, some big issues happen out there, like you said, there's going to be some great opportunities. And if you're not trying to make up losses, you're going to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. And I'm just, I look at this world from 10,000 feet, and I'd rather be buying low and selling high instead of buying high and hoping it goes higher. It just doesn't seem to make a huge amount of sense. We still need to have our money invested. We still need to see some growth. I'm sure heavy cash, I don't have a problem with cash in the bank at this point, as long as it's a short-term fix and it's not just the huge yin and yang that we've seen. Now, when we say cash, I'm still talking about, especially people in retirement or heading into retirement, you should have at least 50% of your investable net worth in safe investments earning something. But if you want to have 20% of your money sitting in cash and then 30% of your money sitting in the stock market, I don't have a problem with that. That's a very conservative posture.
Mm-hmm.
Being heavy cash, we're still talking about having some safe investments that are earning you 2, 3, 4, 5%, you know, without the risk of a 2008 event. I keep saying that we have a hairline trigger, and I don't know that I have a hard time seeing, certainly we can't time it, but I have a hard time seeing the 2008 event without something kicking it off. And there's so many things that could kick it off, but we keep brushing them under the rug. You know, we've got a Puerto Rico filing bankruptcy on that much money or restructuring that much money. And we're probably not going to hear about it much ever again.
We're not hearing much about it at all.
We brush it under the rug. We, you know, got issues in China, but those keep getting brushed under the rug. They have so many people, and they're trying to grow their quote-unquote middle class, and that's been the huge growth in the world's economy, that investing, it has to be very individualized. And if you have enough money in today's dollars to take care of yourself and your own retirement, then by all means, you should really be leaning on safety right now, because the future is such an unknown, and everything is historically as high priced as it possibly can be in the world of investing, especially when we talk about bonds and you know, obviously some of these stocks that we see out there are just crazily priced versus what the company is really producing. And
yeah, but you know, I'd like to make another point just to make sure everybody keeping score at home can follow along. I mean, the stock and bond world they've run together for 35 years, right? Stock prices have gone up, bond prices have gone up for 35 years, right?
Yeah.
But understand that is along with interest rates going down. Now, effectively, interest rates are zero. Understand, stock, there's no ceiling to a stock price. Who in their right mind 10 years ago would have thought, excuse me, that Amazon's valuation would be $500 billion? Who in their right mind would have thought that Tesla, that is just hemorrhaging cash and that never come close to a profit, would have a valuation over $300 a share and more market cap than GM. There's no ceiling to stock prices. There is a ceiling to bond prices, and we're here.
Yeah, and that's math.
That's math. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Interest rates hit zero, bond prices hit their ceiling. Let's, again, throw out Japan and Europe.
No, but even Japan, I mean, how negative could we go?
Yeah,
you can include Japan in that.
Yeah, the interest rates at zero, the bonds just hit their ceiling. So when you're talking about buying low and selling high, I want to emphasize that in the bond world more than in the stock world.
Sure,
because the stock world,
completely agree.
High price stocks just keep
going,
getting more highly priced. So I wanted to make that clear distinction.
Yeah.
Because it's an important thing to understand, especially with the credit cycle tightening.
Yep, and that's something that affects all of us, and the debt world, we have to be very careful in working our way through that and leaning towards safety. There's nothing wrong with it. When you're in retirement, it's the return of your money, not necessarily the return on your money. It's when you cross over that bridge and you realize that you're more afraid of a 20% loss than missing out on a 20% rise in the market. And so if you're in that position, you're the lucky ones out there that have enough money to fund their own retirement, I certainly think you should be leaning on safety. And I think you should really think twice about that safety being the bond mutual funds. I struggle every time I look through a bond mutual fund, and the yields on these bond mutual funds are 2% after fees, and I just shake my head. I just don't understand why I would be in a investment that I'm considering safe, and it's only paying 2%. It just seems absurd to me. So we've got kind of a abbreviated schedule for the summer. We're starting to head into summer, and our classes, we're going to keep going up in Prescott. And for all of those listening up in Prescott, we're switching over from the Prescott Library to the Prescott Adult Center in July. We've got our May class, Warning Financial Instruments, that's coming up next week, and Grayson will be up there doing that talk. We're going to stay at the Scottsdale Mustang Library all summer, and we're switching over to 10 a.m. Just to get done before the heat really comes on throughout the summer. So next month we'll switch over to 10 a.m., but next week we'll be at the Scottsdale Mustang Library at our usual time, 1 o'clock. Let's see. We also added Mesa Red Mountain Library for the summer. We're choosing to attempt to stay doing the classes every month at the Mesa Red Mountain Library all the way through the summer. We're switching to Fridays at 10 a.m., so keep an eye out for the schedule over there. Working on some new classes and always updating our existing classes, so keep your eye out for them. We got a nice busy schedule through the summer. I'll be out of town a lot of it, but Grayson's going to stay here, change diapers, and fill in for me occasionally. Does that sound good, Grayson? Sounds like a fun summer.
Yeah. I don't know about changing diapers in the office. Are you in that bad of shape?
Well,
he's referencing my baby.
And that would not be me. So, all right, you have a wonderful week, and we will try to reconvene this conversation next week. We'll try to get back on schedule and keep these podcasts coming. Hope everybody enjoys the summer if you're heading away, and we're not going to see you through the summer. I will talk to you next week. Thank you. Bye.